I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast is adapted from my YouTube channel, and this episode is part of my Vault series, where I'm turning my back catalogue into podcasts. So, if I ever reference photos or things on screen, please remember that these episodes were originally made for video. Also, if research or references seem out of date, please bear in mind as well that some of these episodes were recorded as far back as 2016. I just want to make sure that all of my content is available on podcast as well for you to enjoy. If you wish to find me on YouTube, I am just Georgia Marie over there, and with all my disclaimers out of the way, enjoy the episode. Today we're going to be talking about a series of mysterious disappearances from Ireland, often called Ireland's Vanishing Triangle. It refers to a number of high-profile disappearances in the mid to late 1990s, all of which occurred in roughly the same area, a triangle that follows about an 80-mile radius. All disappearances appeared to share some very common characteristics. All the women were fairly young, mostly in their 20s. They all disappeared suddenly and inexplicably, and there have been no huge clues or leads in any of their disappearances, despite some huge-scale police searches. The common denominator is that there is no evidence left behind, no evidence at all. No shoe, no belt, no purse, no watch, just nothing. They're all just completely dead-end cases. Understandably, the most common theory in this case is that the disappearances are the work of an active serial killer in the area during this time period, but there are other theories and possible explanations that we will explore. There are six victims who commonly feature on the unofficial list when referring to the Vanishing Triangle: Annie McCarrick, Jojo Dollard, Fiona Pender, Kira Breen, Fiona Sinnott, and Deirdre Jacob. Whilst there are a few other names attached to the Irish Vanishing Triangle, these are the six names on the unofficial list, the six names that are featured in the operation the police had to figure out what was going on here. And today we're going to focus on the stories of each of these six girls. So the first name featured on this unofficial list is Annie McCarrick. She was born March 21st, 1966, and was 26 years old when she disappeared in 1993. Now, she wasn't even Irish, she was actually American from Long Island, New York, but she had this Irish heritage that she had this lifelong interest in. Whilst I'm not entirely clear on the details of her move to Ireland, it seems like she'd been travelling back and forth between Ireland and New York since 1986, attending St. Patrick's College in Drumcondra and Maynooth. She headed back to America in 1990 to get her master's degree before moving back to Ireland again full-time in January 1993, where she planned on becoming a teacher. In the meantime though, she was working in a restaurant from which she failed to pick up her last ever paycheck. Annie lived in a flat in Sandymount in Dublin with two flatmates, Jill and Ida, who saw Annie last on Friday the 26th of March 1993. They saw her in the morning that day, when they stuck their head around her bedroom door to let her know that they were off home to the country for the weekend. Home alone, Annie decided that she wanted to go for a walk in the foothills of the nearby Wicklow Mountains. She had invited a friend to go with her, but the friend was unable to do so, so Annie decided to go alone. It was her favourite place to walk in the area. But that wasn't her only plan for the day, she also had some errands to run. CCTV captured her at the Allied Irish Bank in Sandymount, where she withdrew some cash from her account. She then does some shopping at a supermarket in Quinsworth before heading back to her apartment to drop off her groceries, before deciding to catch the bus to the mountains for her walk. She was last 100% confirmed sighted on the number 44 bus from Ranelagh to Enniskerry at 3:40 that afternoon. She was seen by one of her co-workers, so it was definitely 100% her on that bus. But there were some other potential sightings after this. At Johnny Fox's pub in the village of Glencullen at sometime between 9 and 11 p.m. that night. Annie had been to this pub before, it was a fairly popular venue in the area, and the doorman later came forward after seeing Annie's picture in the newspaper. He described how Annie had come to the door of what was called the Hooley Room and went to walk through the door without realising that she had to pay £2 to enter. It was an Irish music and dancing show that night called the Hooley Show, and so Annie and the doorman had a brief interaction, and he said that Annie was accompanied by a man who was wearing a wax jacket. This man paid for Annie's entry and continued paying for her drinks throughout the night. No one ever said they saw Annie leaving the pub though, and nobody has ever been able to identify the young man that she was with. Multiple people actually ended up coming forward to confirm they did see Annie in the pub that night. So the sighting is believed to be very credible. It is generally believed that she wasn't Johnny Fox's. It just hasn't been completely confirmed. The route of the number 44 bus that Annie was seen on that afternoon ended in Enniskerry, and the investigators on Annie's case say that they're reasonably satisfied that the journey took her beyond Milltown, which is close to central Dublin at least, but they don't know if Annie took the journey all the way to Enniskerry or not. Did she end up going to Enniskerry and getting off and doing her walk in the foothills of the mountain as she planned? Or did she, for whatever reason, end up getting off the bus at an earlier stop? Strangely, either way, it doesn't seem like the number 44 route would have taken her anywhere near Johnny Fox's pub. So either way, there would have been a decent walk for her to end up there. But let's say that Annie did make it to Enniskerry and she did do her walk in the mountains as she planned, because we have no evidence to suggest otherwise. The walk from Enniskerry to Johnny Fox's pub was about 6 kilometres, that's about an hour and a half walk, and it was a cold, wet and miserable evening. It would have been dark, or at least getting dark by the time Annie was walking. Did Annie really do that walk along those dark country roads on her own, or did she potentially meet someone, maybe this young man that she was seen with in the pub? Maybe she met him even earlier, possibly even on the bus, and never even made it to Enniskerry. If that's the case, Annie caught the bus at 3:40 p.m. What were they doing in the hours and hours before being spotted in the pub between 9 and 11 p.m? Investigators have never been able to piece together Annie's movements between when she was seen on the bus at 3:40 and being seen at the pub late that night. Nobody noticed that Annie was missing immediately. As I said, both her flatmates had gone home for the weekend, and so there was nobody to notice when she never arrived home that night. It wasn't until the next evening, the Saturday evening, that anyone noticed that anything was amiss. She had organised a dinner date with two friends who arrived as planned on the Saturday, but they knocked and knocked at the door to no answer, so they decided to go and wait in the local pub, thinking that Annie had probably just lost track of time. Half an hour later, they head back to her door, but there's still no answer. Later that night, they ring Annie's house phone, but once again, of course, there's no answer. So in their concern, they eventually decide to ring Annie's mum over in New York, Nancy McCarrick. Nancy was actually due to be coming over to visit her daughter in just a few days, and it was something they'd both been really looking forward to. And people were even more concerned when Annie didn't even turn up to work at Cafe Java on the Sunday. It was also eventually found that the groceries that Annie had picked up on the Friday were still sat on the kitchen table, ready to be put away. She clearly intended to do this when she returned from her walk that evening. As soon as they heard that their daughter was missing, Annie's parents flew over from New York, and Annie was reported as missing roughly 80 hours after she was last seen. It wasn't long before Annie's case was classified as a murder investigation, and the search for Annie was exhaustive. Although Annie's father is quoted as saying that at first it was difficult to get the police to take the idea of Annie as a missing person seriously.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Apparently, the police said that she was an adult and could disappear if she wanted. But luckily, it didn't take too long, and there was soon an inch-by-inch search on foot through hundreds of acres of woodland and the Wicklow Mountains. About a week after she disappeared, the police released their first public appeal, asking for anyone to come forward with any information about Annie's movements that day, and it's at this point that the doorman and others at the pub come forward with their recollections. Despite all the sightings of Annie though, and the exhaustive search of the mountains, no trace of her has ever turned up. She just vanished. Annie was a white female, she was 26 years old when she disappeared, but she would be 54 years old today. She was 5'8" and weighed 140 pounds with brown hair and an American accent. People in Ireland probably would have noticed her if she spoke. On the day she went missing, she was wearing a dark coloured tweed jacket and oxblood coloured cowboy boots. She was also carrying a tan shoulder bag. It's believed that she was murdered and potentially buried somewhere in Dublin or the Wicklow Mountains. There have been a number of potential suspects identified in Annie's case. When investigators delved into her personal life looking for clues, they found that she'd been in a brief romantic relationship with a man that she worked with and had actually met up with him the previous Saturday, although she later told friends that she'd gone too far with him and just wanted to forget about the whole situation. From what I can gather, the police did look into this, and it turns out the man had a girlfriend and a potential alibi. Although I'm not too sure if any of that is even true, I only saw that angle mentioned in one source, so very much take that with a pinch of salt. There were other more reliable suspects/stories though. After years and years of this being a cold case, the case was actually reopened in 2008, and two suspects in Annie's murder were identified, although it doesn't seem like either of them have ever been publicly named. Both reportedly lived in the Wicklow area in 1993, and neither of them had criminal records. I can't tell you much more about either of these suspects. I can only assume the police are still looking into them or have managed to rule them out. This was 12 years ago now. But in 2015, new information came to light after retired Detective Sergeant Alan Bailey, one of the main people involved in the Vanishing Triangle operation, released a book called Missing Presumed, looking at the investigation. In this book, he talked of this theory that Annie met an IRA man that night, saying that his information came from a very reliable source. Bailey says that the man was a hitman for the West Belfast Brigade of the IRA, and at the time he was on the run as he'd fallen foul of higher ranking IRA members. This man was apparently staying with friends in a warehouse in Dublin, and on the night in question went to Johnny Fox's, where he ended up meeting Annie. Throughout the evening he starts bragging about his exploits in the IRA, naming all the names, but then he realises the enormity of what he'd done. Annie couldn't be allowed to leave the pub and start spreading what he told her, he'd sealed her fate by this point by blabbing. According to the book, he offered her a lift into town, a lift home, but ended up driving her to the mountains where he killed her and concealed her body behind some bushes. He then returned the following day and concealed the body properly. Despite this apparently being from a very reliable source, it doesn't seem like the police have ever really been able to follow up on this lead properly, and rumour has it that the man ended up moving to the USA. Nancy McCarrick said that she was stunned to hear this new information, as no one had ever mentioned anything of it to her, so I can assume that the police never really thought it was that reliable. For now, Annie's disappearance slash murder remains unsolved, as are all of the disappearances I'm about to share. The next name on the list is that of 21-year-old Josephine Dollard, who is known to everyone as JoJo. She was 5'5" with dark hair and blue eyes, and she was the youngest of five children. She'd lost her parents at a really young age, and it seems like she was raised mostly by her older sisters. On the day that JoJo disappeared, she was visiting Dublin, and she was last seen wearing black jeans, a black jacket, a white top, and black shoes. It was the 9th of November 1995, and JoJo had missed the direct bus from Dublin that she was meant to catch home to her hometown of Callan. She manages to catch a bus that would take her a portion of the way there, but she knew she'd most likely have to hitchhike the rest of the way. According to Google Maps, a straight car journey today from Dublin to Callan is about an hour and 38 minutes. So it probably would have required JoJo to thumb multiple different lifts to get all the way there. Jojo was last seen in the County Kildare village of Moon, which is about 57 minutes outside central Dublin. She was seen making a phone call from a telephone box. A couple of the sources mention how Jojo was actually talking to her best friend on the phone when she was last seen, potentially around 11:37 p.m. She's telling her friend on the phone how she's hitchhiking her way back home and that a car had just pulled up, so she was going to try and get a lift from it before hanging up the phone. And this was the last time she was ever heard from. A short time later, a woman similar to Jojo in description was seen leaning against a black door of a dark coloured Toyota Carina, talking to the occupants. Despite multiple searches, the occupants of this car have never been traced and no one has ever come forward. There was also another potential sighting of a woman similar to Jojo's description in Castle Dermot, County Kildare, which is around 5 miles away from Moon. This would have been around midnight that same evening, so only 23 minutes after she was talking to her friend on the phone. Castle Dermot is one step closer on her journey home to Callan, so it's well within the realm possibility that Jojo may have been given a short lift to Castle Dermot and then started wandering the road waiting for another person to pick her up. Was it the person in the Toyota Carina that harmed her, or did the person in the Toyota Carina just take her to Castle Dermot where Jojo thought she'd get the next lift, or was it the next person to pick her up that harmed her? It's believed that she was abducted between 11:50 and 12:05 a.m. that night, and the police urged farmers in the area to search their land for Jojo or anything that could be a potential clue. Despite an extensive investigation into Jojo's disappearance at the time and widespread publicity, she has never been found. And whilst her case has been a part of the Vanishing Triangle investigation, it was pretty soon considered to be a cold case. Police speculated that Jojo had likely fallen victim to a serious sex offender, and a local rapist called Larry Murphy was questioned but ultimately ruled out. Her older sister Kathleen has fought for years for answers as to what happened to her sister. Just last year, new information came out about Jojo's case when a father, Willie Purcell from Kilkenny, received an anonymous letter after making a plea to the public for information about Jojo's disappearance. He said that he brought this anonymous letter straight to the Garda, and that it stated in the letter that they had some information in relation to a missing person. The writer didn't mention Jojo by name, but it's assumed that it was most likely about her, as that had been the case that Willie had been asking about. Father Purcell said about the letter, "They outlined various circumstances and situations that they knew of, that they had heard a certain person talking about." So it basically sounds like an anonymous person's written this letter with some rumours they've heard about what may have happened to Jojo. But as far as I can tell, there have been no more steps forward with this though. At the end of 2019, investigators opened up a brand new probe into Jojo's disappearance. And this was the first time the cold case unit had re-examined all the evidence in her case. The new investigation is set to include witnesses from the time being re-interviewed, evidence being examined, and all the intelligence analysed from the start of the original investigation onwards. Jojo's older sister Kathleen says that she's very pleased with the new review of the case and believes that this will be a deeper investigation with the manpower required. Her and her family have made no secret of the fact that they believe that the first investigation was very, very poor. The next disappearance was that of 25-year-old Fiona Pender on August 23rd, 1996. She was 7 months pregnant at the time of her disappearance to her partner, John Thompson. She was a part-time model and a hairdresser. She was 5'5" with long blonde hair, and she spent the day before she disappeared shopping for baby clothes with her mum, who said that Fiona was in very good form and looking forward to the birth of her baby. Although by this point she was fairly immobile, she really struggled to walk long distances or travel at all. It was just the stage of pregnancy that she was at. It's for that reason that when she went missing, her family immediately knew that something bad had happened, because Fiona just couldn't walk that far, she couldn't really travel. She was last seen by her partner at her flat in Church Street in Tullamore on Friday, 23rd of August, 1996.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Her partner spent the night at his family's farm outside Tullamore that night and had no idea that Fiona had disappeared. It's believed that she left her flat at some point that day, only to be taken off the street. She likely wouldn't have been wandering far on her own, she literally just vanished, never to be seen again. There's really little I have to share about Fiona's case because it was literally just a case of her disappearing into thin air. There's only a few interesting leads here. She just disappeared. She was reported as missing the very next day, but it took 5 days for the police to issue a national request for information about her disappearance. And it was only at that point, 5 days later, that a local man came forward and said that he'd seen two men carrying something that looked like a rolled up carpet out of the building in Church Street where Fiona had been living. He said that these two men placed this bulky object in the boot of a four-wheel drive and drove away. Despite the lack of leads in this case, there has always been a main suspect to the police though, although it doesn't seem like he's ever been publicly named. The police have said that he was a man well known to the Pender family, although he wasn't a member of it. Working on the theory that this man was the killer, several people were arrested and questioned by investigators in April 1997, two men and three women, but it never led to anything, just disappointment for Fiona's family. Over the years, they've used information supplied by members of the public to search and excavate land around the area, but there's never been any answers. There was a small clue in 2008 when a small wooden cross bearing the name Fiona Pender was found on Slieve Bloom, a mountain range in Ireland. I'm actually going to put the spelling of that there because I'm very aware that I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. Slieve. I couldn't find out online how that's actually pronounced, so if there's anybody local to this area and wants to let me know, then please do. But yeah, this is how it's spelt. In 2014, the police renewed their public appeal for help in tracing Fiona, nearly 20 years on. Around this same time, there happened to actually be a big lead that came to light that made it appear that this case is actually on the brink of being solved. A woman living abroad, I think in Canada, came forward accusing her husband of a range of violent sexual attacks on her. She went to the police in her own jurisdiction and told them of her suspicions about his involvement in the disappearance of Fiona Pender. She said that she suspected her husband had murdered her, and he'd strongly implied on occasion that he'd killed Fiona and his wife would be next. The woman also pinpointed an exact location where she believed Fiona's body was buried, saying that her husband had brought her here almost 10 years earlier and said that Fiona was buried there. Combined with evidence from the early stages of the investigation, it seemed like Fiona may have actually been buried in the Slieve Bloom Mountains, the same place that the wooden cross was found a few years earlier. There was also a motorist who came forward saying that he was almost forced off the road in the direction of this mountain by a four-wheel drive driven at speed on the night of the day Fiona was last seen. So, a team of investigators started their search in an isolated wooden area that they'd identified as being the possible burial place of Fiona. But they made it clear that they weren't 100% sure that it would yield any significant results. The chief superintendent said, "This is not to say this will be a successful search. It's just part of the ongoing investigation into the disappearance. This will be a forensic search. We'll be employing the services of our own specially trained people who are trained in searching for persons who have been missing for substantial periods of time. We're also engaging forensic archaeologists, cadaver dogs and others to search this specific area of approximately 200 square metres. Now, despite an extensive search in this area, there was nothing found, not even the smallest clue. Investigators now believe that the woman who came forward with this information was deliberately lied to by her husband, and there's been nothing further in this case really since. The fourth name on the unofficial list is that of Ciara Breen, a 17-year-old girl from Dundalk, County Louth. She went missing on February 13th, 1997, and she was 5'5", 112 pounds, with shoulder-length, dark brown hair and blue eyes. Ciara's disappearance is a little bit different from the rest. She was last seen by her mother, Bernadette, who said the two of them had gone to bed just after midnight that day. They were both in the house, it was a day as normal as any other day. But about 2 a.m, Bernadette gets up to go to the toilet and realises that Kira's missing. She's not in her bed. And she found that Kira's window had been left on a latch, suggesting that she'd purposely snuck out of the house after her mother had gone to bed, most likely to meet someone. Maybe this was something she did quite often. Leaving the window unlatched meant that she'd be able to sneak back in without anybody hearing anything. It was just chance her mother woke up at 2 a.m. and realised she wasn't there. But no one really knows where Kira went that night. Unlike a lot of the other cases here, there has always been a very strong suspect in Kira's case, in the form of a man called Liam Mullen. Over the years, he's been arrested twice, but has never been charged with anything, and he's always maintained his innocence. He ended up dying of a suspected overdose in a Dundalk Garda station in 2017, and he died when he was 55 years old, meaning that he would have been around 35 years old when Kira disappeared. Sources say that had Kira's body ever actually been located, Mullen would have been charged with her murder immediately. So whilst they can't share any evidence the police have against him, it seems like they were pretty convinced in his guilt. At the time of Kira's disappearance, Mullen lived at a property on Bachelor's Walk, which was just yards away from Kira's house. He insists he had no relationship with Kira other than saying hello to her on occasion. But is it possible that it was him Kira intended to meet up with that night? Or was she meeting up with somebody else and happened to run into Mullen on the way? Kira's friends told investigators at the time that she had indeed made arrangements to meet Mullen that night. They claimed that he'd approached Kira and her friends on the day before her disappearance, and they overheard her making arrangements to meet him later that night. He denies that this conversation ever took place, but he becomes the prime suspect pretty early on. After the disappearance, lands belonging to Mullen and his family were searched for Kira's body, but nothing of value was ever found. In August 2015, investigators started searching local land, focusing on an area called Barmer's Bog, which was just this marshland. This was on the back of two credible witnesses coming forward a year earlier with potential sightings of Kira in this area on the night she disappeared. The police had recently released a fresh appeal for information from the public, and this is what they came up with. They also received two anonymous letters around the same time, which also pointed towards this area. But despite searches, nothing of significance was ever located. Former Detective Inspector Pat Murray said of Kira's case and the search, "It's one that disappoints me to this day. We were sure she was in the bog with the chief suspect the night she disappeared. We were so close to finding her, we needed a bone, a toenail, just a toenail. That's all we wanted." I think the investigators were convinced they were going to find something in this bog, but the investigation was hindered by the fact that 500 tons of rubble was dumped in this area in the years after Kira's death. It was just covered with topsoil, and this halved their chances of finding anything. Whilst Kira's name is often included on the list of disappearances linked to the Irish Vanishing Triangle and the rumours of a serial killer, the lead investigators on her case say they know that she wasn't killed by a serial killer. They said that the evidence they had against Mullen was solid, but without a body they just couldn't prove she was dead. They couldn't charge him with murder. It was a case of being so close, but so far. 19-year-old Fiona Sinnott was the next to disappear on the 8th of February 1998 from Ballyhit in County Wexford. She was 5'2", around 7 stone, with auburn hair and brown eyes. Fiona had an 11-month-old daughter called Emma and was really looking forward to celebrating Emma's first birthday at the time she disappeared, as well as looking forward to her older sister's 21st birthday, for which her family had this big party planned. On the evening she disappeared, Fiona had spent the night at a local pub called Butler's with friends. She was in really good spirits that night. She was chatting and laughing with her friends. At one point she called her brother to invite him along to join, but he declined because he'd only just returned home from work. Also at the pub that night was Fiona's ex-partner and father of her daughter, Sean Carroll. Now, he wasn't there as part of the friendship group, he was just apparently sat at the bar alone with a pint. Shortly after closing time, Fiona headed back to the home that she rented and shared with her daughter. On the night in question, Emma was being babysat by Sean's parents. Now, this was a Sunday night in a small town with very limited transport links. Fiona's family insists that it's highly unlikely that she would have left Ballyhit, especially without her daughter, who she just absolutely doted on. But investigators were later able to confirm that Fiona didn't leave the pub alone that night. Her and her ex Sean had left the pub around the same time. When he was later contacted by police, because obviously he was contacted, he told them that he'd walked Fiona back to her home, and when they arrived, she went straight to bed because she wasn't feeling too well. He said that he spent the night sleeping on her sofa before his mother arrived to pick him up at 9 a.m. the next morning. Just before leaving the house, he goes into Fiona's bedroom, where he said that she was lying awake in bed and she was still in pain. She complained to him of having pains in her arms and her upper body area. She told him that she intended to go see her doctor later that morning, but that she had no money and intended to hitch a lift to the surgery.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So he gives her about £3 in cash before leaving, just so she can catch the bus there. She had told her family the same thing, that she was going to see a doctor that morning, but there was no record of her ever having had a doctor's appointment that day, and she was never seen again. Now, it was a number of days before anybody realised that Fiona had gone missing. She was an incredibly independent teenager, she was a mum, and she lived 16 kilometres away from her family and her family's hometown of Bridgetown. While she remained in regular contact with her parents and her older siblings, this was before mobile phones were widespread, and Fiona could often go a couple of weeks without contacting them at all. That was pretty normal behaviour for her. So nobody thought anything of it when they didn't hear from her for a few days. They eventually realised something was up 10 days later. Every Friday, the family would meet for a coffee in Wexford, to which Fiona would catch the bus. But on the second Friday in a row when she didn't turn up, they really began to worry. And throughout this entire time period, Emma had stayed at Sean's parents' house. I don't know at what point they're intending to give her back to Fiona. So her family report Fiona as missing, and as you can imagine, the first person the police contacted after Fiona was reported as missing was Sean. He told them his own account of the night, which I've already shared, and it seems like the police did believe his version of events, or at least they had no evidence to suggest anything else. In the early days of the investigation, various leads were followed up and inquiries were made, but every single one of them led to a dead end. She'd never turned up at the doctor's surgery that morning, nor were there any sightings of her in public, no sightings of her taking a bus or hitchhiking a lift. A forensic examination was carried out inside her home and no evidence of foul play was found. But something the police found very interesting was the complete absence of clothing and items in this house that indicated that a teenage girl and a baby daughter were living there. Quote, it was as if the house had been laying vacant all the months Fiona had lived in it. There just wasn't really anything there. After an appeal for public information went out, a local farmer contacted the investigators, saying that he'd actually found a load of black rubbish bags on his land. Now, he'd assumed that it was just somebody illegally dumping rubbish there, it happened quite a lot, so he actually set fire to them. But before he did so, he checked for an address in the contents of these bags. He found letters with the name Fiona Sinnott on them and an address in George Street in Wexford Town, which is where Fiona had lived before she moved to Ballyhit. The farmer said he thought nothing of it at the time because the address didn't match the one on the missing persons appeals. There was also another strong line of inquiry that included an English lorry driver that Fiona had met while she was on a night out at the Tusker Rock Hotel in Rosslare on the Friday, February 6th, 2 days before she disappeared. The two spent the night together in the cab of his lorry, and the next morning he caught the first ferry from Rosslare over to England. It was suggested to police by a friend of Fiona's that she may have left for England to follow this driver. The driver, however, was traced and immediately agreed to meet with investigators. He admitted to spending the night with Fiona, but was never a strong suspect as he had a strong alibi for the entire weekend. He was literally in a different country working the entire time. It has been suggested that Fiona also left for England to start afresh, but everyone who knew her mentions how her daughter was the centre of her universe. She wasn't struggling with motherhood, she loved being a mother, she wouldn't have left Emma. In June 1998, a nearby lake in Ladies Island was drained in their search for Fiona. This operation was huge, it lasted an entire month, but of course, no trace of her was found. There was also another tip about a male who had apparently assisted in the disposal of Fiona's body and was struggling to live with what he'd done. The person to whom this male had apparently confided in suggested that he tipped off investigators anonymously to the location of Fiona's body. But he refused to do so because this man claimed that only the murderer and two other people knew the exact location and that tipping the police off would be the same as signing his own death warrant. Now, the police knew the name of this man and he died of a suspected drug overdose in 2001. It may have been suicide, but the authorities aren't too sure. Was he telling the truth? Did he help somebody bury Fiona's body? It took 7 years until Fiona was legally classified as dead in 2005. The police announced that Fiona's case was now being treated as a full murder investigation rather than just a missing persons investigation. And over the course of 3 days, 6 people were arrested. There was the prime suspect, the suspect's mother, his sister, his sister's boyfriend, his ex-girlfriend, and a male friend. After questioning, however, each one of these was released. But files outlining their potential involvement in Fiona's disappearance were submitted to the Director of Public Prosecutions, the people who get the final say on whether charges are filed or not in Ireland. In the end, though, they decided not to press charges. These arrests apparently came on the back of some vital information received from a woman that knew the main suspect. No names have ever been released, so whilst we can take guesses about who this main suspect is, we don't know for sure. Just last year, a documentary was released that looked into the disappearance of Fiona, and it brought to light brand new information uncovered through access to Fiona's medical records, which indicate that she may have been a victim of domestic abuse. She was kicked, bitten, punched in the face and head up until she was 6 months pregnant. These instances of abuse go back as far as to 1994, when she would have been only 15 years old. At one point, she was brought into hospital by police, but was not prepared to make a statement to the authorities. She told them that she'd tell her family of what was going on, but she never did. Again, we can make guesses as to who the perpetrator of this abuse was, but we don't know for sure. But it shows that she was clearly in a close relationship with somebody who was violent and abusive. As of February 2017, detectives had conducted 459 inquiries and taken 355 statements. These numbers are probably significantly higher now in 2020. They were due to carry out a fresh forensic examination on Fiona's home, but I assume nothing more came of that. Investigators renewed their appeal in April 2017, saying that a motorist had seen a male and a female on the roadway around the time that Fiona had left the pub that night. There were reported to be two males in their late teens hanging around nearby, yet neither of these people ever came forward and they're still being traced. Police are desperate to find out who these two males were because maybe they saw something. And of course, there's still no sign of Fiona. The final unofficial name on this list is that of 18-year-old trainee teacher Deirdre Jacob, who went missing on July 29th, 1998. Deirdre had been living in London while she was studying at St Mary's University, but she was home in Newbridge, County Kildare for the summer. She was 5'3", slim build with grey eyes and dark chin-length hair. On the day she disappeared, she was wearing a navy V-neck t-shirt, navy or black straight jeans, and blue Nike trainers. She was also carrying a very distinctive black satchel bag with long shoulder straps and the word CAT in large yellow capital letters printed on the front. Now, Deirdre's disappearance is possibly the most baffling of the six, as she literally disappeared on the road outside her house. She had spent the day running errands and visiting her grandmother in the middle of town, and as with Annie McCarrick, the last things known for sure about Deirdre's whereabouts were all captured by security cameras. She was captured at the local bank and the local post office, and she was captured walking down the main street of Newbridge. After running her errand, she started to walk home down a country road that she'd been walking down her entire life. She got within 200 yards of her home, she was seen by neighbours about to cross the road to walk up her driveway, and then suddenly she was gone. There was just nothing, no trace of her has ever been found. She was literally snatched off the street in broad daylight and nobody saw a thing. From the last place she was captured on camera, it was about a 10 to 12 minute walk to her home. In that time, 8 people spotted her, including 6 people who knew her personally. She was carrying a really distinctive handbag that day that a lot of people remembered paying attention to. But as with Deirdre herself, the bag has never been found. From what I can gather, the police are incredibly close to solving Deirdre's case, possibly closer than any of the rest. They say they're at an advanced stage, and in 2018, the case was reclassified as a murder investigation due to some new information that came forward, although they don't really make it clear what this information was. By that point, investigators have conducted 3,200 lines of inquiry and taken 2,500 witness statements. In the October, it was stated that they had significant new leads and they publicly identified a man called Larry Murphy as a person of interest in this case. You may recall that I also mentioned Larry Murphy's name in relation to Jojo Dollard's case. He was a suspect but ultimately ruled out. But in the year 2000, Larry Murphy had been arrested for the abduction, rape and attempted murder of a young woman from Carlow. The entire case was under eerily similar circumstances to many of the stories I've just included in this video. And Larry Murphy was connected with Deirdre Jacobs' family, having done carpentry work in a sweet shop owned by Deirdre's grandmother. It's claimed that Murphy got drunk one night in prison on homemade alcohol and boasted of how he once abducted a woman outside Newbridge. He reportedly claimed that he pulled in alongside a young girl on the road just outside of Newbridge, waved a map in her direction and asked for directions. When the girl leaned in through the open window to try and see where he was pointing, he grabbed her by the hair and dragged her into the car, forcing her into the front passenger seat. I mean, that sounds like a pretty believable confession to me, and investigators believe so too, believing the girl he was talking about was Deirdre Jacobs. Murphy was released from prison around 2010 after serving 10 of his 15 years, and he moved to Europe shortly after that, although it's now believed that he lives in London. Following a massive review done on the case in 2018, the police focused in on Murphy. Reportedly, a man who was previously a close associate of him claimed to have significant incriminating evidence. This man said that he knew that Larry Murphy was responsible for Deirdre Jacobs. The investigators travelled to London also in 2018 to question Murphy, but he refused to cooperate and there's no basis there to arrest him. Until this year anyway, it seems. An article I read dated the 3rd of March 2020 reports that investigators are to submit a file to the Director of Public Prosecutions in relation to this case, recommending the arrest of Larry Murphy. The DDP will decide if the evidence is strong enough to make a case against him, and I really hope that there is enough evidence here, because it sounds like he has given a pretty accurate confession. I assume the procedures are going to be delayed here though because of the whole pandemic thing, so I'm going to be keeping quite a close eye on Google to see if any more progress comes in this case. And Deirdre isn't the only Vanishing Triangle case that Murphy has been connected to.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So in the year 2000, like I said, Murphy was caught attempting to strangle a victim in the Wicklow Mountains, the same place that Annie McCarrick was walking on the day she disappeared. Now Murphy's victim in 2000 only survived due to the luck of a pair of hunters walking in on the scene, saving her life. And he also matches the description of the man that Annie was seen with in the pub that night. He also lived in the same area as Jojo Dollard, he was a very big suspect in this case at the beginning, and he travelled a lot across this region due to his work as a carpenter. It's also very interesting that as of his incarceration in 2000, the vanishings just kind of stopped. The media dubbed him the Beast of Balton Glass. But despite all of this, it doesn't seem like there's ever been strong enough evidence to link him to the disappearances, at least until now. In 1998, on the back of Deirdre Jacobs' disappearance, a task force was created by the authorities, titled Operation Trace. It was a major inquiry into the disappearance of several women in the area during the 90s, set up in the hope of finding some connection between these six cases. As I mentioned at the beginning of this video, it's long been suspected that the disappearances were the work of a serial killer, and this is a theory that Operation Trace worked on for many, many years. But after several years, the task force had to come to the conclusion that all six cases were unlikely to be the work of a serial killer. In 2014, the investigators behind Operation Trace publicly said, "In the end, we can name viable, independent suspects in five of the cases." I mean, we know that at least in the cases of Kira Breen and Fiona Sinnott, the police believe the perpetrator was somebody known to the victim personally. So whilst it's unlikely that the same person was responsible for all six cases here, it probably wasn't a serial killer, it is likely that Larry Murphy could be responsible for more than one. Or at least another person could be responsible for more than one. You've got to admit that for so many young, fairly similar looking girls to go missing in a fairly small region under very similar circumstances does raise questions. You can't blame the authorities here for originally thinking that this could be the work of a serial killer. But sadly, for the majority of these cases, it's looking unlikely that they will be solved in the absence of any bodies. How have none of these bodies ever been found? That is a lot of bodies that could be potentially buried in one 80 square mile area of Ireland. Surely it will only be a matter of time before somebody just happens across at least one of them, you'd hope. In a lot of the cases, the authorities are unable to charge anyone with murder without proof of murder. Like I've said, there are other names that are potentially linked with the Irish Vanishing Triangle cases, but those are the main six ones. They're the six ones that Operation Trace really focused in on. I'm in agreement with them. I really don't think it is the work of a serial killer. I think in at least two of the cases, it's most likely somebody who's related or is very close to the victims. But I think there is definitely something deeper going on here. I think Larry Murphy is a very good suspect. I think it is very possible that there was one singular person driving around this area in Ireland in the 90s looking for very similar looking girls to potentially assault and murder. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Mysteries and Histories. If you have a bit of time, I would love for you to go and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and spread the word. It would be much appreciated. I'll see you next week.